the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
Hello, loyal listeners. It's your old buddy, the Chris Keeper. I'm so excited. I just received my Demanza Corp Subliminal Podcast Expansion Kit. All I have to do is pick a track of soothing music or, say, relaxing Tweety Birds on a dewy morning and add it to my podcast. Sub-audio Demanzaphonic technology takes over from there. Why am I telling you all this? Because when this podcast is over, you'll feel relaxed, refreshed, and will remember none of this. Instead, you'll remember an amusing and informative podcast about John Carpenter's seminal They Live. You'll remember myself, El Jacone, and the hair metal hero. But you'll also have this vague memory of a mysterious stranger named Mike Cross who says bad puns and throws in his 2 cents every now and then. So, relax and enjoy the podcast. And you're beginning to feel all the energy sap from your body as it drains into the spinal cord.
All right, and this is going to be an awesome, awesome episode of the show because we are going to be talking about They Live, which is... As I was talking to the hair metal hero before the show, this could possibly be my favorite John Carpenter movie of all time, if not one of my definitely one of my favorite movies of all time. What about you guys? Do you guys love this movie?
Oh
as
yeah.
Much as
well,
I
mean, the thing that's always odd to me about They Live is that you know, I'm a big wrestling fan, and
me too.
when this movie was coming up, you know, because Roddy Piper is in it. Vince McMahon would hype the living heck out of this movie on WWF programming back in the day. So even as a little kid, you know, I was like, oh man, I want to see They Live. It's got Roddy Piper in it, you know. And my dad, of course, didn't let me see it until I got older. But so, you know, it was always on the radar. And even though, you know, the general concept of, oh, there's aliens and you can see them with these special glasses, you can grasp that so simply as a kid. But it's not till you're older that all of the allegory starts to make sense. And you can just enjoy this film on so many levels. This is definitely deserved of its reputation that it holds as being an underrated little cult film.
It's my second favorite Carpenter film, Behind the Thing.
Mm.
Behind the Thing?
Yeah.
All right, so after this episode, all your best Carpenters are behind you. Oh, jeez.
You could just quit now.
You could save the Thing episode for the last one. Just so you don't have to peek out early. Yeah, what's funny is by the time this movie came out, I had not been following wrestling for a long time, so I didn't know the whole Vince, which is funny because, you know, Vince and his wife are, you know, decidedly, you know, Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a pretty, you know, and not as much anti-Reagan as much as, you know, just the sort of Reaganism or whatever. You know, I don't know if it was pinpointed at Reagan, but it's just another great example of how, like, money will trump anything.
Right.
It's like Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
Or actually, maybe at that point, Vince McMahon wasn't that politically even...
Well, Vince has always been, you know, pretty conservative, but... You know, it's the same thing because in 87, you know, when Predator was coming out, you saw little clips of Predator every week on Superstars or whatever because Jesse Ventura was in it. You know, politics aside, you know, Vince is ruled by the almighty dollar. Everybody knows, you know.
Yeah.
That's the way the business works. But, you know, but as far as one thing that I was struck by watching They Live Again, because this is the first time I've watched this film in a couple of years, And I agree with you. Is that, you know, from the time frame of when the film was made, and you know what we, you know, can presume about and know about John Carpenter's politics, it's kind of, you know, an anti-Reaganism, you know, trickle-down economics sort of mid-80s excess. I think at one point the lady doing the voiceover for the fashion commercial says "divine excess," which I think is a great turn of the phrase. But I was thinking about it, and then think about this: the aliens don't just control, you know, your traditional, what you can traditionally consider to be things Republicans control, you know, big business, you know, churches and stuff like that. They also control things that we always think about being leftist, like the media and fashion and, you know, broadcast television. These are all things that, you know, me as a paranoid conservative all think that the left wing controls. So in the end, it's the concept of the ruling class, you know, which is
the power elite.
The power elite, exactly. It's ideologically independent. It is, we're in power and we're going to screw with you because we can and because you're
yeah, it's ideologically cheap. Neutral.
Yeah. And I think I mentioned this last time. I said no matter what your beliefs, your morality, your ethics, your ideology, you're always afraid that somebody out there is trying to screw it up.
And it's definitely anti-corporatocracy.
Yes. Yeah. Which again ties back into the whole, you know, your 80s heyday of trickle-down economics.
Well, the 80s was the beginning of, you know, when corporations were going from being corporations to like these mega, you know, insanely huge corporations and absorbing each other, and, you know, where the definition of like maybe what a monopoly is was becoming gray and all that. What I love about this movie is not only how it sort of transcends politics, but it has even influenced politics through its to the point of where watching it, you know, I mean, from going to film school, it's a double-edged sword as you learn to watch movies and try to put them in their sociological context and all that. And so there's a temptation of when you watch this movie to go, okay, you know, the Reagan 80s, you know, homeless people, you know, this was the time when the phrase homeless was first coined, and, you know, and it's sort of an exaggerated version of that because it was set, you know, in the near future past that, which is our near past now. But, you know, now when you look at it now, myself, who I love the conspiracy theory stuff, I've been watching Alex Jones now for almost a decade. It's insane. I can't believe that I've been paying attention to that guy for that long. But, you know, people like Alex Jones loves this movie, quotes this movie all the time. David Icke, one of my favorite conspiracy theories, is a British guy who used to be a Green Party candidate, and before that he was a soccer star. That's how he started out, as a soccer star who moved into the Green Party.
Oh, that's your typical career path, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, he's the guy who brought forth the whole, you know, theory that's now one of the great conspiracy, not great as in great in size, but great as in just awesomely paranoid and fun to read about, is the, you know, the reptilians who run the world, the reptilian aliens, whether they're from another planet or interdimensional or whatever, you know, it's yet to be determined, or it depends on who you're talking to. But, you know, David Icke is the main proponent of it. You know, he has the, if you've ever listened to him, he'll talk about how, you know, Queen Elizabeth is a reptilian who will eventually, you know, have a ceremony where they eat fear, you know, like a lot of monsters in Star Trek eat fear. So they've gotten a lot of this stuff from different sources, but a lot of it seems to come from this movie.
Yeah.
and you know, that's what the reptilians, there are people who actually believe there are reptilians, you know, using us for our resources right now, who have co-opted our elite. And that movie was kind of a way of their rubbing, depending on who you're talking
to. It's a documentary to this guy.
Yeah, they were either rubbing it in our faces by putting it out there as entertainment, or John Carpenter is a great freedom fighter, and the reptilians are so confident in their power that they let him live, you know, after he put this movie out. Or maybe they ate one of his children or something, and he hasn't been putting out any more politically, you know, motivated movies after that or whatever. But yeah, that, but now watching it, all that stuff is hung up on top of it too. And it's just, it's even better. It makes it even more fun to watch it. It's like, it's created its own subtext on top of subtext. And
it, I mean, and, for what was pretty much just a low budget, you know, little movie made in the wake of, we talked about in our Prince of Darkness episode that when the studio screwed with the ending of Big Trouble in Little China, you know, they signed, Carpenter got the deal where he could do a couple of low budget films where he had creative control, and this was the second of those. So for what was, you know, essentially just kind of a low budget sci-fi movie, it really has taken on a life of its own. I mean, people who have never seen this film know, if you put on the glasses, you know, you can see the sign that says Obey. They know it's from They Live. It's that movie with Roddy Piper where he fights the black guy in the alley. But that's about it.
Yeah.
So it's entered into the pop culture lexicon. You know,
which I wonder if that's still the longest. When that came out, that was like the longest filmed fist fight.
Now, I did a little math of my own. That fight scene is 6% of the running time of the movie.
Wow.
And you know what's even more amazing? Is that in the original shooting script, it was supposed to be about 30 seconds. And
really?
And Piper and I can't remember the name of the gentleman who plays Frank. He plays Child in the thing.
Keith David.
Yeah. They got together and said, well, let's do this legit, you know, because Piper's a legit tough guy, you know. And so they actually fought it out. The only things that are faked are all the shots to the groin, and the shots to the face are worked. But everything else is a shoot. You know, just to keep the wrestling talk going on this episode. And Carpenter just loved the idea. It's like nobody films a realistic fist fight in Hollywood. Just two guys wailing on each other.
Well, we were in the movie theater, and my girlfriend's going, what is going on? This fight won't end. And I'm like, John Carpenter has a wrestler in one of his movies. Why not use that, you know? I mean, here's someone who knows how to choreograph a fight. And I was thinking, if you got somebody who knows how to choreograph a wrestling fight, and if maybe Carpenter was like, I'm going to watch, or was a wrestling fan to begin with, you know, you watch them and it's just directed like your standard sporting event. They're probably watching it going, man, if I had a good, you know, three camera shoot on this, I could really, you know, really get a good angle so it looks even more realistic, you know, when they crush each other's crotches repeatedly. it was very much, I think that during this time period, there was this weird, like, we're going to make, because this is within a year or two, I think, of Big Top Pee Wee, isn't it? Which had, like, the world's longest held kiss in a movie scene.
Mm. It was right around that. That was the late 80s, I know.
So these were two movies that at the time were like Guinness Book of World Records fodder, you know, for the, and I love the idea of that scene that, you know, the idea that like, if you want to show someone the truth, you got to beat the, you know, on some level, you got to beat the hell out of them.
Right.
You know, you sort of have to force them into the truth and they will fight you every step of the way, you know, to,
I've seen you do that online.
Uh-huh. But you know, the thing about Roddy Piper and why he's in this film, Carpenter is always quoted as saying is that because it was easy to cast Piper as Nada because he's got life written all over his face, you know, and that somebody like Kurt Russell, who is a rough and tumble, a rugged guy, doesn't have the kind of that hard times look that Piper brings to it. And one of the notes I have here is that Nada is in many ways kind of the zenith of what I call Carpenter's the hard luck hero. You know, guys like Snake Plissken, guys like Jack Burton, guys like Bishop or Melanie Ballard from Ghosts of Mars. You know, just that hero that life has just really just fed through the crapper, and they're just this hard person. That's all that's left. You know, and you don't fuck with them because you know if you do, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What were you saying, Chris?
Basically, I talked their hardness and their dignity and their intelligence.
Yeah,
is usually all that they'll ever have.
Yeah, but Piper does look a little rough. It's there was one shot where there was a lot of sunlight on him, and I could see, you know, how scarred up his cheek was. I thought, Oh, it's Roddy, Rowdy, Rowdy, Roddy, Reinhold.
And
there's more to come, guys.
And you know, the amazing thing about this is, I think I've told Hero and Chris this story before, but my closest friend in the world lives in San Diego, and his name is Bob. And Bob is a former professional wrestler, and he now works. He's also an author, and he works stand-up comedy. Actually, it's funny. He works stand-up comedy at a club that he also bounces at. So it's like, you might remember, it's like, hi, folks, you might remember me as the guy that checked your ID at the door. But Roddy Piper now does...
The guy who'll kick you out if you don't laugh.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's like, it's the ultimate power. But Roddy Piper now does the stand-up circuit as well. Basically just telling, you know...
Oh, great.
Just telling stories from, you know, shooting and stuff, you know? And Bob got... Bob ended up opening for Roddy Piper. And so he got to see, you know, go to Piper's show. I don't remember if it was in San Diego or in L.A., but Bob got to open for him, and he said that it was, first of all, it was an amazing thing meeting Piper and hanging out with him and everything. But he said that during the set, at one point, Piper says, you know, I made a movie called They Live, and the place exploded. And he said it was like a standing O just for him name-dropping They Live. You know, it's like...
As it should be.
It says it should be, right, but it's like... You know, at the time, it's like, oh, Roddy Piper? Seriously? But it's like, not only is Piper perfect for this, but it's defined part of this guy, this, you know, famous wrestler's career, being in this movie, and it's made him into a pop culture hero for being in this.
It overshadows a lot of his wrestling career, to be honest.
I mean,
you know,
you think of Roddy Piper, what are the things most people think of? It's They Live, you know, hitting Morton Downey Jr. with the fire extinguisher and smacking Jimmy Snuka in the head with a coconut.
Oh, the coconut.
Jimmy Snuka. Oh, my God. I remember when Jimmy Snuka got arrested in Watertown near Mike's in my hometown. And when they were bailing him out, the local radio personality actually was interviewing Classy Freddy Blassie and got called a pencil neck geek, and it was like one of the high points of my childhood. It's just like, Freddie Blassie called Jay Donovan a pencil neck geek. Oh my God, that's so awesome.
Back when I was a kid, life was going swell. Till something happened, blew everything to hell. That night my daddy stumbled in, all pale and weak. Set a woman up the block. Just gave birth to a geek. Mom said, sell it to the circus. What the heck? Dad said, nope, this one's a pencil neck. And if there's one thing lower than a sideshow freak, it's a gritty, scum-sucking pencil neck geek. You see, if you take a pencil that won't hold lead, looks like a pipe cleaner attached to a head. Add a buggy whip body with a brain that leaks. You got yourself a grit-eating pencil neck geek. Pencil neck geek, grit-eating freak, scum-sucking peehead with a lousy physique. He's a one-man, no-cut, losing streak. Nothing but a pencil neck geek. Soon the geeks were popping up all over town. You couldn't hardly sneeze without knocking one down. After a nice juicy steak, if you need a toothpick, just reach for a geek. They'll do the trick. One day we cut one up for fish bait. Learned our lesson just a little bit late. Soon as the geek hit the drink, the water turned red. Next day, sure enough, all the fish were dead. Pencil neck geek, gritty freak, scum-sucking peahead with a lousy physique. He's a one-man, no-good losing streak. Nothing but a pencil neck geek. Any night, you know where I can be found. Yeah, stomping some geeks head into the ground. So keep the faith, cause in Blassie you can trust. I won't give up till the last geek bites the dust. Pencil neck geek, gritty freak, scum-sucking D-head with a lousy physique. He's a one-man, no-gut, losing streak. Nothing but a pencil-neck geek. They say these geeks come a dime a dozen. I'm looking for the guy who's supplying the dimes. It's gonna be real hard times for all of these grit-eating, scum-sucking, boot-licking, drop-kicking, gut-grinding, nail-biting, glue-sniffing, scab-picking, butt-scratching, egg-hatching, sleazy, smelly, pepper-bellied, dirty, lousy, rotten, stinking freaks. Nothing but a pencil-neck geek.
Well, for our listeners who don't remember the early 80s wrestling scene, Jimmy Snuka almost murdered his girlfriend or fiance at the time, and that's why he very quickly disappeared from the...
That's why he got arrested in Watertown.
Right, that's what I mean. That was after that, you know, I mean, the Iron Sheik got arrested so many times for drug possession that it was a joke, but he'd always come back. You know, Snuka, after that, Vince didn't want anything to do with him for over a decade.
The Iron Sheik was at Dragon Con when Scott and I went to Dragon Con, and I was the only one in our group who was like, oh my God, guys, that's the Iron Sheik standing over there all alone, you know, like alone looking around with his turban on. and like, I'm like, the Iron Sheik is standing over there and nobody's acknowledging this. Is anybody acknowledging this? Anybody? That's the Iron Sheik over there.
I got a quick aside. My 30th birthday, my buddies all took me out surprise party at a big Chinese food place north of Boston. And my group of friends were all wrestling fans. And in walks the fucking Iron Sheik and his entire entourage, and he's wearing a T-shirt with his own face on it. And one of my buddies is of Iranian descent, and he fucking, it's the fucking Iron Sheik. Everybody's over there. We're all taking fucking pictures with him. It was a fucking riot, man. Like, of all the people to see, you see the Iron Sheik.
Yeah, and the thing about the Sheik is that I guarantee you, he fucking loved that. Because
he loved it.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like
the name of an extra thick condom, though.
Yeah.
That'd be the Iron Sheik.
Iron Sheik. God. Oh.
I have my own wrestler story is I used to have a job at a bank, and during the middle of the day I would go on courier duty, so I would run like legal documents to all these local businesses, so I would get to run the streets of Rochester, and it was always around lunchtime, so my lunch break would come in there and I would always find a nice bench to sit down and, you know, eat a little food. And one day I was sitting and I can't remember what book I was reading, but it was a science fiction novel. And I was, you know, sitting by a bench by our local, it was called the War Memorial at the time. It's the Blue Cross Arena now. And there's all these trailers set up behind it, but whatever, there always are, whatever's coming in. And I'm just reading my book, and who's standing next to me but Hulk Hogan?
Wow.
And he's like, hi, how are you doing? And he's like, I'm Hulk Hogan. I'm like, yeah, I know who you are. And he's like, were you waiting around for an autograph? And I'm like, no, I'm just on my lunch break and reading a little book. And I'm like, will you autograph my book, though? And I can't remember what it was, but I've got, like, some science fiction novel autographed by Hulk Hogan.
That's awesome.
So he wrote, keep reading.
That's awesome.
Didn't tell you
always
to, you know, prayers, train, vitamins.
Drink your milk.
Believe it in yourself.
Great demandment.
Yeah. I was like, you know, I was like 25 years old at the time, you know, but he's still going to be the positive influence on youth. And it was funny because he had this whole complete air of, you know, a little bit of ego because he assumed I was there to see a wrestler, but at the same time, just completely down to earth. You know, he was just very, you know, friendly, and, you know, he was literally coming over like, oh, someone wants an autograph, I should go over and give him an autograph, you know, and be friendly. It was really cool. And I've noticed that seems to be a common thing, unless you're a woman who meets Superfly Snuka at a bar, you know, in Watertown, New York.
Well, you know,
things tend to go bad.
We'll get back to the movie, sure, but I'm sure all of our listeners who want to talk about They Live love all our wrestling shit. But, you know, you're absolutely right, because I've met a bunch of wrestlers, both through Bob and through just my being a ring rat, you know, at back in the days of like ECW and stuff when I was back in New York. But, you know, most wrestlers will tell you that, you know, they do this because they love doing it and they love the interaction with the fans who are not assholes. You know, so the guys that are there saying, hey man, you know, great show tonight, you did, you know, good match, whatever. You know, they're the guys that they're the ones that are paying to see you, that are paying, that are getting you over. You know, so they're usually more than happy to spend some time with you if you're a genuine guy about it. I mean, I met one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, Chris Candido, may he rest in peace, in the Danbury Fair Mall in, 1997, I think. But this is when Tammy was working for Vince and he was working for ECW, and Tammy was doing an autograph signing. And we found Chris in the mall, just shopping. And we talked to him for like 30 minutes in the mall while he was waiting on Tammy. And I remember because at the time ECW hadn't done any shows in Connecticut. And he said, yeah, guys, we're doing a show on Halloween night in Stamford. And you guys got to come. And I said, okay, I'll be the guy with the Candido is God sign. And so sure enough, on Halloween night in Stamford, Connecticut, in the shadow of Titan Tower, which is the headquarters of the WWF, they had a show, and everybody dressed up in Halloween costumes because it was Halloween. And so at one point, and we're at the Twin Rinks in Stamford, so it's got the pull-out bleachers, you know, in addition to the folding chairs. And so after everybody finished their match, they'd come out and sit on the bleachers for a while and watch the rest of the show. Well, Candido and Tammy came out after his match, and Tammy's got this big bag of candy. She's just snarfing down candy the whole time, right? And so I go over to my sign and say, Chris! And he looks, he goes, you're the dude from the mall! Awesome!
That's awesome.
But you know what else is awesome? John Carpenter's They Live. That is an awesome
That's a
movie.
Good movie. You're right. That is a good movie. I think I'm going to defuse. I think I'm going to derail our wrestling show for a minute, and let's talk about that horror action sci-fi classic.
Let's bring up a salient point here. We all know, you know, the glasses let you see the aliens. Where exactly do they find the glasses? Does it have any? Yeah,
they're manufacturing them in that lab.
How did Hoffman figure this out? The titular Hoffman of the Hoffman lens.
Well, yeah, it seemed like they were manufacturing it in that church, but they only had a few beakers.
Of urine and a bunch of test tubes full of blue stuff.
Right, but they had boxes and boxes. So I wasn't sure if maybe they were maybe they were working on the contact lenses and somebody else have been shipping. Yeah, they might have just been like
a way station. I had a feeling they were like really mobile, that they went from place to place.
That there was kind of like an underground railroad going on.
Right.
Of
with beakers of
sunglasses,
urine and
people, yeah.
And you know what? And
test tubes for all.
And the thing when you talk about that, when they're set up in the church, there's two kind of classic Carpenterisms that happen in that scene. First is when Nada's in there just snooping around the first time, and he turns around right into the street preacher.
Uh-huh.
That gets back to that Howard Hawks, the popcorn flying up scene, you know? It's just a classic gotcha. But it's so typical Carpenter. Yeah. It's like, and every time it's like, yeah, you know. And then,
but the thing about him is, it's, you see, people don't get that is a good part of a horror movie, but it has to have a reason,
right?
You know, he backs that up with one character interacting with another character and imparting information on some level at the end of it. Whereas most people, when they do it, it's a cat jumping out from a garbage can,
right?
You know, or something like that. That's what I like about Carpenter is there's really not too much that he does that's gratuitous, unless there's even a reason for it being gratuitous, like the thing.
Yeah.
You know.
But then the second half of that scene, when the police roll in and just destroy the place. What was interesting to me is my note here is that quiet intensity, and it said reminds me of all the scenes in the basement in Prince of Darkness, where, you know, there's bad stuff going down, but it's kind of matter of fact about it, you know,
because
they bring in the bulldozer trucks and they just roll that place out, and it's just business as usual for these cops, you know. They don't, you know.
You're exactly right. It was intensity.
Yeah.
Oh. Mike likes puns, by the way, guys.
Yeah.
Next time. I'm just making a little mental note on my mental chalkboard to next time have a wet blanket and a cattle prod for these occasions, but we're just going to have to put up with it this time, I think.
But
he's got 4 pages of notes, so.
And it's all puns.
But I tell you, that scene, that I called it the pogrom on my notes. That was just, that's just another a classic Carpenter thing. It's just, you know, it's something that in the hands of another director might have been something like a spectacle, which is the wrong note for that scene. That scene has to be, it's like, oh, it's just taken out the trash. You know, it gets back to that whole
quietly scrubbing away the shady
town. Like we talked about before with you know, what is this, a film that's anti-Reagan? Well, one of the great knocks, of course, on Reagan was he didn't care about the homeless, and that's just throwing away the trash, you know? And that's
funny,
the tone
here. You remind me of one thing I noticed in this movie that happens in a lot of movies, but it was a running theme in this movie, is there's lots of scenes of, you know, people who, like, there's a scene where there's trash in the tent city, and there's plenty of scenes where Roddy Piper is on the run, and he'll be in an alleyway or something, and a cop car will go right by him, and he'll duck away.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I mean, he's an obvious, like, mass murderer. They're going to see him, but there's a scene where he's got the kid, and they head down the alley, and then the cops are coming. But it's just because the cops are so robotic that it's like they're not stopping and thinking for themselves and going, there's a guy and getting him. You just have to sort of get in their way. And what they'll do is they'll throw up 8 million cops walking in a line so you can't get past them. But there's no independent thought or independent personality. You know, all the cops have face masks on, too. And when you see their faces, they're, you know, bland. But it's very, it reminds me of the robot cops in THX 1138,
right.
You know, where they're just sort of going about their business, you know, robotically. Yeah, the power structure is shown as being faceless, and that stuff has become more of our vocabulary since 9/11, you know, is that sort of look, you know, or that sort of feel with... not necessarily in reality as much as say
pop culture
and like on the internet and stuff like that. When you start looking, especially when you start looking in like conspiracy theory world.
Yeah, well, the nature of the conspiracy theory is that you need to demonize the people at the top because they're the ones, committing these atrocities, and that's exactly what we do here. Is that, you know, it's I always like the bit at the end of this when they drop into the tunnel, and they run into their pal from the shanty town, and he's sold out.
Right.
And it's like, you know, this was a guy with his head in the sand to begin with, and then he finds out the truth, and instead of like Nada and Frank becoming a crusader, and I'd also like to point out that Nada goes from a guy whose line is, I don't bother nobody, nobody bothers me, to mowing down people in the street pretty damn fast.
he doesn't think...
He's like, there's aliens. I'm going to go show them now.
They're aliens, and they're ugly as shit. Kill them instantly. He does not...
Burn out high face.
But that's what I loved about this movie, is I was like, that, you know, he was portrayed as a guy who is... not dumb, but, you know, not too... He was, like, on the smart edge of dumb, maybe.
But he wanted the work and was beaten down and couldn't find work.
He was earnest...
Very powerless.
Know, earnest and curious person, hard worker, you know, just wants to make his way and...
Snappy dialogue.
Right, yeah. With charismatic. He's got some charisma, but he's still humble.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, that kind of person is being portrayed as the kind of person who, like, you know, he instantly saw, this is what's going on, this is wrong, destroy. Without any thought, you know, a more intellectual character would have been like, all right, I better just, like, play this cool. And then figure out what's going on and then make a plan of either getting away or ending this. Not him. He just, like, starts wiping them out and lets, you know, basically momentum carry him through to the end of the the movie. It works out, sort of. Not really for him that much, but for humanity, I guess.
Gotta tell you, the first time I saw this film, I don't know how long ago it was, but it was probably not long after it was out.
Yeah,
I think I saw it in the theater, actually.
20 years or so ago, yeah.
Oh, man, when he first put on those glasses and all the signs changed, that scared the piss out of me. It really did.
Yeah.
I was like, yee, that's creepy.
You know what I thought? My first thought was, of course.
And then when he saw the first alien, I was like, yeah!
I was just like, I'm like, this is a documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, it made sense. Watching it now, I feel like I'm halfway to where the preacher is.
Yeah. I think we all are.
If you get me wound up and talking about it.
Uh-huh.
And the funny thing to me, again, as a conservative watching this, is again, when they're in the scene where they're having the big gala for all the power alliance, you know, and they're the guy who was in Shacktown with them says, it's business, that's all it is. You know, I always love when a character breaks that out. You know, hey, it's just business, you know. Because it's this, again, it's this very 80s
it's
attitude
right
of like,
they,
it's business.
Right after,
there's no morality with
someone.
Business. It's just business, you know. I don't feel bad that I'm you know, conspiring with aliens that are using us for some nefarious purpose that is unclear. It's just business.
Well, yeah. What I found funny about that scene is those guys just stride into that three-piece business suit meeting,
yeah.
And every head doesn't turn to look at them.
Right.
You know, they come in, and I'm just
like their faces aren't known by
them.
Well,
they have guns at their sides, too. They slowly, like, tuck their guns. and you know, no security guard notices or anything like that. But, you know, I mean... If too much scrutiny on this movie,
yeah.
it's just not gonna stand up, because it's like I'm noticing things like, oh, look, there's caterers that are you know, in on the whole lizard, you know, deal, you know, caterers, really?
Well,
spilling the beans?
There's a line from the old Incredible Hulk cartoon from like 1982, even bad guys got to eat.
Which
is one of the truest statements
of all. I'm not saying you could recruit. I've worked catering.
But how do
before,
you keep
man.
It a secret with all that catering?
Yeah, I was just gonna say I've worked catering plenty of times before. You could recruit anybody from catering. You told them, hey man, you want to cater to the lizard people, you'll be rich for the rest of your life. Yeah, they'll do it. But the kind of people I was working with, I wouldn't trust any of them to keep the secret.
Well,
you know.
Maybe you know they cater the one event and then they get liquidated.
Then they get. Then
they come and they bulldoze their catering
one.
their catering shop, and you know, put a Starbucks there.
Yeah, what would the Starbucks sign have read if you put the glasses on?
I think the Starbucks sign would actually just stay the same. You know, they're so blatant and bald-faced about their, you know, their consume advertising. I guess it really wouldn't change much.
Well,
maybe the girl's face would get a little uglier on their logo.
Oh, somebody needs to draw that up. Who's an artist?
We're taking our cat to the vet, and we actually saw... I can't remember it's an offshoot of another store, but it's... for baby clothes, but it's actually called Buy Baby Buy.
Bye Baby.
Bye Bye Baby.
Yeah.
And I was just like, how? Yeah, it was almost like you were wearing the glasses. You know? It was just like, come on, you're not even trying anymore.
Yeah, that's how apathetic we've gotten.
Well, that was like Scott Gardner's family. Someone in Scott Gardner's family had a business called Eat It and Beat It.
Eat It and Beat It, yeah.
I can respect
that. Nothing subliminal there.
You know, I
get your chow, sit down, eat, shut up, leave.
I think a guy who went to my worked at my school got in trouble for being at a place called Eat It and Beat It once, but I think that might have been a different establishment.
I was gonna say, yes. Yeah, there's also places with entertainment and food that are called Eat It and Beat It. But what's funny is right down the street from like within a mile of Eat It and Beat It was another place simply called Bar Food.
Right. In my hometown.
With a white sign with generic lettering that
bar
just said Bar Food.
And frankly, food should have been barred from that place.
Yeah, it burned down eventually. But that place was, I mean, that sign literally looked like the signs in They Live. It was just a black on white, you
know. Got,
I'm surprised they just didn't knock the OOD off so it just said barf, which would have been really...
I tell you what. If
apt.
You, now, hold on. If you take... all right. If you're in South Carolina and you're driving to Myrtle Beach, okay, if you're from anywhere except on the coast already, there's pretty much only one way you can do it because of the way the interstates are in South Carolina. So you've got to take I-26 to I-20, and you take I-20 to Florence, and then you pick up a couple other roads to get out to Myrtle Beach. Well, in between Columbia and Florence, South Carolina, on I-20, there is a giant sign that it is like, it's got to be at least 75, 100 feet in the air, okay, on a big pole attached to this old, you know, small restaurant. It just says, eat.
Yes.
Does it say, eat food, eat at Joe's, just eat?
Well, that's in case the ownership changes. Once you erect a sign that big, you don't want to have to change the damn lettering, ever.
I just love that. It's just like, okay, I've got a thing of
They've had the paper
on
the letter, too.
My buddy took a picture of that.
They should have spelled the E-T with a... They should have spelled the E-T with the long symbol over the E's. So you can just pronounce it E-T.
I was just going to say...
only pay for two letters.
I was just going to say
I've got
two
a... My buddy had the picture of that. I've got to find it. Because that is... Oh, every time always we think it's like E-T. That's your only message you wish to convey. I'm sorry.
When you come right down to it, it's the only message they need to convey, you know? They'd follow it up with shit, but you're not going to pay them to shit.
Yeah. This ain't a truck stop.
Yeah. P. E. You can do one letter for that.
Wow.
The eating P. There you go.
Wow.
You know what?
Anyway.
You know something else odd that I noticed in this, and this has kind of been a recurring theme, is we've talked about any time you see... a television, you know, there's usually something interesting going on the television.
Yes.
And if it's, you know, in this film, there's a lot of television that's diegetic. You know, there's a lot of news broadcasts and TV commercials and things of that nature, which are used for diegetic purposes. But at one point, when they're in the shantytown, they're flipping around the television, we get the, what year was that? I want to say it was like 1957 film called Monolith Monsters. And that's the shot with the big black spire collapsing down and crashing.
Collapsing onto the something.
Yeah,
yes.
And this is a film. Basically, it's about an alien spore that lands on Earth, and when it's exposed to Earth's atmosphere, it starts growing into these giant black monoliths. Okay, and they collapse under their own weight, and end up that's how they crush and destroy the planet. So I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about, again, we're always trying to think, what does the television mean? What does the little throwaway scene in the TV mean? It's like, the only thing is, okay, well, these are monsters from another planet that are crushing humanity. They're growing fat off of our, you know, our planet, and they just carelessly crush everything around them and without
and when it,
concern.
And when it crushes, yep, they'll move on to the next one.
Yeah.
There was the line of dialogue that we are their third world.
Exactly.
And there also was a hint that a lot of what their polluting was doing was also a sort of a form of terraforming, that it was also possibly making it
it's changing the atmosphere,
more CFCs,
more like their native world. And it's funny because it was also another little, it was just a throwaway line early on about hints of a possible like germ warfare or bio depopulation or something, because they were saying, you know, I hear there's some sort of disease up north, you know, it's killing a lot of people, or, you know, they're saying it's, you know, a plot or something like that. There's just a throwaway line like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things like that in this film where if you're not really thinking about it, it's just, you just, you know, it's just background dialogue. But pretty much everything has, you know, some purpose to the narrative here. You know,
well, this movie is so lean and mean, that everything in it pretty much is there for a reason or shades something in a little more. You know, there's hardly anything superfluous or just sort of...
The only thing that's really, to me, superfluous is the very last shot.
The breasts at
the end. The tits at the end. and then because,
breasts.
But, you know, the thing is I can picture it in my head. Like, oh, yeah, he's going to destroy the dish, and everybody's going to see the ghouls for what they are, and they're going to see them on TV and in the bars and everything. And that's, and I got to imagine John Carpenter saying, "Yeah, and somebody's going to be fucking one of them."
Yep.
Well, to me, it was just a multi-level anticlimactic end.
Well,
baby, what's wrong? I mean, what's more anticlimactic than baby, what's wrong? I mean, in all facets of life, because, I mean, I think we've all been there.
Yeah, right? He left it with quite an absurd...
Beige. I think I'll paint the ceiling beige.
Absurd moment, yes. But at the same time... But it was weird, because really, like, if I would have been doing it, and maybe I probably would have been not as subtle as Carpenter about it, but, you know, okay, you know, you have your metaphor there. The guy is fucking the Earth girl,
yeah,
you know?
And,
but in the movie, she's on top.
Right. No, but that's the,
so
here's
she's
the thing,
in the
though.
Dominant position.
I was, no, she's in the dominant position, but think about it. He's getting, you know, he's getting his rocks off. He's not doing a damn thing.
He's just laying
there.
Yeah,
he's not even holding her hips or anything. He's like, yeah, go ahead and service me, Earth bitch.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right. And, but, you know, I like that he left it where you don't really see, you just have to interpolate what the inherent panic that would come from people instantly, you know. And on top of it, when I started thinking about it, I'm like, also a lack of that signal or some sort of, when the signal isn't working, don't you get like a headache and everything? So basically you'd have a really like pissed off
populace
with a migraine. Yeah. It could be really bad, yeah.
Also very amusing, of course, to see Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert are actually ghouls.
Yeah.
Which explains a lot.
maybe a little response to, I don't know about Siskel, but I know Ebert's probably said some bad things about The Thing.
Yeah.
I seem to think it was Ebert.
And I want to say that part of that was at least in response to Creepshow, because they say John Carpenter and George Romero. And I want to say that those guys both kind of did a number on Creepshow. But I may be mistaken on that. I'm kind of shooting from the hip.
That could very well be. I always wondered about why Roger Ebert would get these strange, all of a sudden, jags of, like, sort of being very, you know, puritanical and stuff. Whereas, you know, he was writing movies with Russ Meyer.
Yeah.
One of the most
That's the thing with Ebert. Ebert loves tits. It doesn't matter how salacious it is or whatever. He will defend female form in all of its glory in any movie.
Yeah,
he's like Ed Wood in that respect. Ed Wood was the same way.
Yeah, well, Russ Meyer. Yeah, Russ.
It was Russ Meyer. So
Russ Meyer's had his boob thing. So I'm assuming that probably Roger Ebert and him probably shared that. It was my favorite Russ Meyer line of all time was, you know, the line, you know, she has a balcony you could read Shakespeare from. And I think he's the originator.
I always like the line from the John Travolta opus, Look Who's Talking, when Kirstie Alley sees her boobs have gotten bigger after childbirth. She goes, I look like I'm in a Russell Meyer movie.
He came to Rochester, and it's really funny because I worked with this girl who had extremely big boobs and had a subscription to the film series that he was going. She's like, I'm going to see the guy who's speaking tonight. And I look at him, I'm like, oh, it's Russ Meyer.
Oh,
I'm
Jesus.
Like, he's going to talk to you.
Yeah.
And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, not to be rude, but he's you'll see his movie.
Yeah.
You'll see how he feels about boobies.
Yeah, then just
and sure enough, at the end of the movie, she's like, he came up to me after and was just the creepiest man I have ever met in my life. And I'm like, I told you.
Yeah, you gotta make sure you don't wear like that knit top or something, you know.
if my roommate that I live with now, if we ever go someplace where our crumb is, we're going to have to take a baseball bat and like beat him unconscious to keep him from like climbing up on her and riding her like a pony. It'll be a bad scene.
Okay.
It'll be a bad scene.
I didn't realize art.
If anybody's ever seen the movie Crumb, they'll know what I'm talking about.
Well, keep on trucking.
Yeah.
I gotcha. You say Crumb, I always think of American Splendor, you know. I think of him and Harvey.
Picar.
Harvey Picar, you know.
Yeah.
Another great American who passed away recently.
Yeah. Another, well, R. Crumb's still alive.
Anyway. No, but Harvey Pekar, death.
Hey, Harvey Pekar, yeah. No, I know. Yeah, that was really sad. I always liked Harvey Pekar. He was I like the grumps. But they, I know we mentioned this in other shows. They're remaking this movie. And
again!
The steel line from Jeff Foxworthy, boy, you know we're going to screw that up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know John Carpenter has nothing to do with it, because I remember seeing an interview and he's like, I don't know, I think it'll probably be different from mine, where probably, you know, he was basically like, whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, Wes Craven, you know, I read an interview with Wes Craven where he's talking about the remake of Last House on the Left, and he said at this point, they're not his kids anymore. They're kind of, these movies are kind of like his grandkids. And that, you know, if they're going out and being successful, hey, good for them. You know, that it's been so long since they've made these films and they've you know, stopped thinking about them, that it's like, I mean, a lot of filmmakers are just glad that people are still talking about their movies. You know?
Well, that's what I'd say. They don't value their masterpieces like the people who watch them value
right.
them. You know what I'm saying? You know, they to them it was something they did in the past, and they've moved on to whatever they're doing now, you know? And they're like, oh, I'm glad people like my art that much, but they don't focus on it.
I don't know. It'll probably bring on a resurgent interest in the previous one, and people will probably look at the the original one again for the first time.
I mean, there's always going to be your Kubricks and stuff like that who, you know, they view their stuff as theirs, you know, or the Lucases.
Yeah, the George Lucases of the world.
Where it's theirs, nobody touches it, but... You know, I mean, yeah, it's like George Romero. I don't think, you know, George Romero takes his zombie stories as seriously as the people who view him.
Well,
it's obvious.
I mean, Simon Pegg and I can't think of the name of the director of Shaun of the Dead. Edgar Wright.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg. I read a thing where they talked about that. They went and they wanted to show Shaun of the Dead to Romero before they released it, you know, and get his feeling on it, make sure he was cool with it, and so they arranged a screening. They flew out and they met up and they watched it and apparently George had a great time, thought it was real funny, but he didn't even, you know, at one point in that film when Sean's roommate is talking, they're talking to Sean's mom, and he says, "We're coming to get you, Barbara."
Yeah,
you know,
he didn't
realize,
right?
That was from Night of the Living Dead. He didn't even remember that, and they had to explain that joke to him. He's like, "Oh, that's right. I guess she says that."
Yeah, who knows? Who knows when the last time he watched Night of the Living Dead was? Why would he want to watch Night of the Living Dead? You know, he was sick of it probably by the time he was done editing it. You know,
he was sick. He just didn't copyright it. All that money gone.
You know, and that's because of the story behind that is whoever that distributor was. When they changed the title from Night of the Flesh Eaters to Night of the Living Dead, when they put their own card on it, the optical for Night of the Flesh Eaters had the copyright information on it, but the one they put in, they didn't put the copyright info on there. So that's why, you know, it was released as Night of the Living Dead with no copyright information on it. It's like, well, shit. Of course, depending on who you listen to, they did that on purpose to screw him, and, you know, who knows.
Going back to the idea of a remake on this, the biggest thing that is going to be lost, regardless of who makes this, because I can't see anybody doing a good job with a remake, especially in the current political climate, is subtlety. I mean, it's not going to be subtle at all. And the great thing about the one from the 80s is it's subtle up until the point where everything comes down like a ton of bricks on Nada and the viewer at the same time. I mean, you can already tell that it's just going to be completely heavy-handed from the get-go, I think, if they do a remake. But, I don't know, what the hell do I know? I'm just, you know,
well,
looking at
this. There's not a lot of subtlety anymore in science fiction filmmaking, you know?
I thought you were going to say it doesn't have Roddy Roddy Piper in it.
Well, that's obviously strike one.
That's pretty much what made the, I mean... I am so... I mean, what else did Rowdy Roddy Piper do? I know he did, like, Terror Comes to Frogtown or Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Yep. Did them the same year, I think.
But I after I saw this movie, I was like, Rowdy Roddy Piper has a good, you know, I got the same impression I got out of Predator with Jesse Ventura, and, you know, and later on when Marky Mark became an actor, and I was like, wow, this guy's acting career could totally outshadow his music career, you know.
That's happened with Will Smith.
And Will Smith, yeah. I mean, I totally could have seen Rowdy Roddy Piper to where it could be like...
He should have gone into politics.
He could have gone into politics. He could have...
I'd vote for a guy that doesn't hesitate to just, you know...
If he worked on his acting, he could have been doing, I think, like, serious roles after a while, you know, after he worked up some chops. He had a definite chemistry with the camera.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all that goes back
personality
to, you know, we talked earlier about, you said that if a filmmaker could get a hold of a, you know, a wrestling setup with a three-camera deal, it's like, well, then that's, you know, the multi-camera setup that was what Vince McMahon kind of innovated in the 80s for a way that he shot
right.
TV. And, you know, what was Roddy Piper about when he was in the wrestling? I mean, he wasn't a great mat technician. He wasn't Lou Fez. He was a talker. Everything involved psychology. Everything involved, you know, building things up. That's why he was the most hated man in wrestling for so long. And then, you know, after you know, WrestleMania II and all that, when he turned face, he got everybody to love him because he knows how to work a story and you know, create that emotional response from the viewer.
And he's doing that without. And he's doing that live. I mean, if you can entertain somebody for 20 minutes. Off the cuff, live, and if you know you can't screw up.
He could have been the white trash Harrison Ford. That's what I'm gonna say right. That's what I'll say right now.
Well, and you know the
could have been like Harrison Ford with a mullet.
Yeah, the mullet and the Goodnight Irene. This line in this the bubblegum line was
oh,
a leftover
yeah.
that he never got to use in a promo. He said that was something I always wanted to use in a promo, and I never had the opportunity.
And the awesome thing is we're doing this show, and in the near future we're going to be doing a spoiler alert, we'll be doing a black hole show.
I am so there.
And I watched the black hole last night, and it's so funny because you know, like the original theme to the Two True Freaks show is filled with black hole music.
Yep.
And you know, the I've come to chew bubble gum and kick ass and I'm all out of bubble gum line, which I thought was very like obscure when I threw it in there. And when I threw that in at the beginning of it, I started finding out how you know how many people actually know that line and know where it came from.
Yeah.
And the,
I love
the
pulling
thought
it out
behind it
and mangling that line. I do it at band practice. It pisses off the guitarist. I say, I've come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of ass.
Well, you know, actually, I was going to say that was Tom Servo said that on an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, those bastards.
Said I'm all out.
They said
well,
everything. They said a lot
of
things.
It was either Tom or Crow. It was one of the robots that said, I'm all out of ass.
that line holds up.
I wonder if
to
I
me.
Saw that and said it was sublimated.
That line to me is one of the greatest lines ever uttered in a genre picture.
I was in the movie theater, like leaping out of my seat. I was with my poor beleaguered girlfriend at the time. Like, it was like, let's go to the movies. And I always do this with John Carpenter movies. As we get to the theater, and I go, that's a movie by John Carpenter. We're going to see that movie. But I never heard of it. It's by John Carpenter. It's
it
going
matter.
To be good. And I did that with her, and I did that with a group of people for Big Trouble in Little China. And
they probably hated
it. Worked
you.
Out.
Well,
with the group of friends from Big Trouble in Little China, it worked out like gangbusters. With the girlfriend in this movie, she was tolerant from it, but I don't think it was really her kind. I mean, I walked out of the movie, and then like 2 days later, I was just like having somebody else drive me to the theater to watch it again. You know, I'm like, come on, we're going to see They Live. This is awesome. You got to see this.
Actually, as much as I like the bubblegum line, I so prefer Life's a Bitch, and she's back in here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A movie with two great lines like that. That's so
where it doesn't. It's a great line, but it doesn't 100% make sense. But it's a great line.
It's coming
but
to fuck you. Life's like, coming to fuck you. It makes perfect sense.
But I always picture more like you being the one fucking the bitch in heat. So it's like, okay, it's time to have sex with... Yeah, okay, that makes sense a little
well,
bit.
Remember
but it's
what
just
we
not
said
a perfect
that you can't
metaphor,
overanalyze
but I
this
love
movie.
It. Yeah,
you know,
right.
This movie exists to exist, you know, and exists to be yeah. awesome. I mean, I had a nitpick. It's like when he's gunning down the ghoul cops in the alley, people are just walking by behind him.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to break it to you. You hear gunshots in an alley like that, you're going to freaking notice.
You scatter.
It depends what city you're in.
But I mean, it's L.A. It's like, oh, it's just a 9mm. It's nothing to be worried about.
Right.
If I heard a gunshot in Binghamton, New York, I'd just walk the other way.
You hear a gunshot where I am in South Carolina, that means, oh, it's turkey season. You just hear random gunfire. It's like, oh, that's right. The boys are out.
Yeah, I live way out, so I hear that a lot,
yeah,
too.
I mean, yeah, Mike and I grew up with random gunshots from hunting, and now I just hear... not my neighborhood anymore. I don't hear random gunshots popped off here as much anymore, but I've been in a few.
And up there, it's where wealth is measured by how many cars you have on blocks.
In the front yard, yeah, in front of your trailer. That's for show.
You know what's interesting? One of my notes here is that the theme, and Carpenter did the music for this film. What's odd to me is that the theme to this film is very similar to a lot of the music from Prince of Darkness, except with a blues harmonica thrown on top of it. Like,
yes.
It's like you took, like you took the orchestration from POD, hit the blues harp on it, and it's like, okay, now we got Halo.
And it's like a blues chord progression with one chord that's like a little funky. you're thinking it's going 1-3-5 or the blues pattern, and then it's like, oh, well, that's a 6 there instead of a 5, so it has...
It's not exciting, but it does set up that sort of grungy, urban, poverty atmosphere.
Yeah.
It makes it, it places it in the 80s. That was just
you know,
a very
it gives,
80s...
It feels like Detroit, but there's palm trees.
Well, you know, I mean, it's L.A. I mean, that's always been the... That's always been the juxtaposition of L.A. It's, you know, the urban squalor and then the Pacific Coast Highway, you know. That to me is why in some ways Los Angeles is... Well, not in some ways. That's why Los Angeles is the perfect setting for this film. Because it's the most plastic, fake society in the world. You could set this in New York, because New York is the most honest society in the world. You want to see life, that's New York. You know, if you want to see artificial life, that's L.A.
Yes.
If you want to see life with no personality, that's Chicago. Yes, I went there, Illinois. What are you going to do about it? Nothing.
L.A. is one of those cities that I've never had any desire to ever go to for any reason whatsoever, unless maybe I was going to win an Oscar or something, and then it'd be like, yeah, I don't know.
Dude,
everybody
you're
I know who lives in LA, I go, so how do you like living in LA? And they go, yeah, and they change the subject really quickly.
You know, it's like the song by Tool, you know. The only way to fix it is to flush it all away.
That's coming in a couple episodes of this show, too, when we get to the Escape from L.A.
Yeah, I mean, that...
It gets pretty much flushed like a toilet in that movie, I think.
Arizona Bay, man. That's the only way to fix it.
There's something in this movie that I forget about every time until the scene comes up, and that's that really awesome transporter that the aliens have.
I want one of those.
That thing's so cool, just...
What you think about it, basically, you know, Earth might just be like, you know, Atlanta. It's just a Delta hub.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You want to go anywhere in Delta, welcome to Atlanta, you know.
Well, those underground tunnels, those were another, like, conspiracy theory he was so ahead of the times on so many conspiracy theories. Either that or I was 10 years behind John Carpenter, but like the whole series of tunnels underneath, and there's whole stories about that sort of stuff too. I love movies like that just will take the conspiracy theories and throw them all together into one mush that explains them all and explains everything that's wrong with society.
You know, talking about the hidden tunnels, one of the other themes about, of course, one of the main themes is that the hidden evil, and Carpenter wrote the screenplay under the pseudonym Frank Armitage, which is a Lovecraft character. And that, again, the idea getting some connective tissue here with In the Mouth of Madness is the whole Lovecraftian idea of monsters that exist just beyond your field of vision, you know, just past your peripheral vision. And it's in this sense very literal. They literally are just past your field of vision, you know.
Yep. And they're right next to you. They're underneath you.
Yeah, they're all around you, and you just can't see them. It's this whole other...
Right, you're just... The reality's a veneer.
Yeah, this whole other society that exists right now amongst you that you have no idea about, which is a very Lovecraftian idea, and it's one that Carpenter has used several times in different films. Of course, again, most notably in The Mouth of Madness, but also that's a strong influence here.
Well, what I like in this is it also has... And like Mouth of Madness and Prince of Darkness... That's your gothic Luciferian evil. This is your mundane, you know, evil that's not driven by philosophy of like, ah, yes, we are the lizard people. We just love to feed off of fear and death. It's more like, hey, you know, it's money. It's business.
Yeah, we're just here to take your resources, use your labor.
Their tunnels underground aren't these like ornate, evil-looking tunnels. No, they're just utilitarian.
Yeah, they're just slab concrete.
Yep. And they do like the Romans and hire a few locals to oversee local affairs.
Right.
You know, empower them. Yeah. Elevate them.
No big deal. It's the evil of business as usual, you know,
the tragedy of mundanity.
And there's another scene in that tunnel, now that I think of it, another one where like there's guards all over in those tunnels and you know, basically they're just sort of like, you know, doing the Obi-Wan Kenobi thing of just like walking just out of their peripheral vision around them and stuff and nobody noticing them. And that just happens in this whole movie over and over and over.
I love
over
those
again.
Guards when they find out on the radio that they've raided the resistance. And they're like the high-fiving white guys. Like, yeah, we got them.
Yeah.
Whoa, what?
Yeah. Oh, that's right, and they go like, yeah, jogging down the hall.
you just imagine them, you know, again, like just running down, slapping high fives the whole way, you know.
Well, that's another one of the you know, and then you see them, and they're not like, yes, we're being evil. They think they're the good guys.
Right.
They're like, they're sitting there going, yeah, you know.
There's nothing wrong with having what's yours.
Right, yeah, chalk one up for the good guys. These guys are getting into the, you know, these guys are sanding the Vaseline of the way things are, you know.
Can I take a quick step back? You were talking about, you know, that there's a reality, you know, that what we see is a veneer, and then scratch that, and there's a different reality. And talking about, like, this sort of invisible thing among us. That's kind of like the homeless in the shanty town too, because the homeless are kind of invisible. They're there, but you don't notice them so much.
Yeah.
You know,
right?
Well,
and
it's another
course,
reality.
And of course, it's from there that the perception of the other hidden reality is perceived. Is from the you know, the people who are, you know, basically in this movie, you have to be beat. if not literally, you have to be beat down enough to see what's going on. You can't. See what's if you're above a certain level, you either are going to be completely blind to what's going on, or you're in on it.
So,
you know,
it's a willing blindness, though, to a certain extent. Because if you're able to live your life comfortably enough, then you're not going to give a shit about the higher ups or the lower
down. They say, "I welcome our alien overlords."
It's like what's his name? It's like Frank's character. You know, he you know, once he knows what's going on. To him, there's, you know, he's got to fight. But up until that point, he sort of knows something's up.
Yeah.
But he has to be beaten into...
Yeah, he's
into
a family man. He wants no part of it.
Right. He's got his family. And he does it. He knows that if he knows the truth too much, that's going to, you know, that's going to screw up his life.
Yeah.
You know, what little stability and what little he has will go away if he... knows the truth, so he'd rather not, you know.
And going to the hero's point, you know, what is the alien giving the presentation say? He says money isn't the nicest thing in life, it's the only thing. You know? It's this, again, it's this willing turning your eye to it, and the connection, of course, is again turning your eye to the suffering of your fellow man. It's like I got mine. I have arrived. I don't care about them. They wouldn't help me if I was in their position. You know, it's that whole, again, it's a theme that's been just a constant throughout this series, is that, you know, it's like people just don't care anymore. They just don't care. Yeah. They don't care what happens to the fellow man. They don't care what happens to the guy down the street, as long as they're taken care of. You know, they don't care that there's a massacre, and all these people's these people who don't have anything get their homes destroyed and bulldozed to the ground like they never existed, because, well, you know, I've got my this is the 80s, so I got my 26-inch TV and my VHS player and my hi-fi. You know, I don't give a shit. Why should I give a shit?
They summed that whole thing up right in the dialogue too. They said it's the golden rule: he who has the gold makes the rule.
Yeah.
What I like is our hero is also given his name's Nada, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
He's nothing.
He's a non-entity.
You know, what's funny is you don't even hear his name.
His name's only in the credits, yeah.
Yeah, his name's You.
Yeah, it's Hey You.
For a while, I wondered if his name was Hugh, because that's all anyone called him.
But I went and took the liberty of looking up, and I'm going to have to open up my notebook. But this is based on a short story called 8 O'Clock in the Morning by George Nelson, but it's by Ray Nelson. And the lead character's name in that is George Nada. So that's obviously where it came from. But that's the only, you know, you're not going to, you know, that's the only way you were ever going
to
know what his name
was. To wait for the credits.
Yeah.
So it's a weird thing, because I always try to make a note of what everybody's names are, so when we're doing the show, I don't call somebody by their wrong name. And then I was like, you know, about 10 minutes into this movie, and I've seen this movie so many times, you know, that I started playing it forward in my head going, you know, I really don't think there's ever a time in this movie where he's referred to.
I actually stopped the movie watching it yesterday and hit the timestamp, and it was 12 minutes in, and there was still no mention of any name of anybody.
Of anybody.
Not even
yeah.
Frank at that point.
Yeah, I think the first name we hear is Gilbert, isn't it? It's either Frank or Gilbert, but you're right. There's a long stretch where it's just, we don't know who these people are. We're willing to go along with it, but we don't know who anyone's called. Which is funny, because, of course,
it makes it more allegorical, you know?
I like it when he first meets Frank, and he's kind of following him. He's not walking with him. He's sort of following him. I'm thinking, man, when Frank gets home, he's going to have to explain to his wife, well, this white boy followed me home. Can we keep him?
Yeah. I always like that line. It's, I don't like people following me. Well, I don't want to follow anybody until I know where they're going.
They have to both, well, they, you know, it's that whole John Carpenter thing of where they both recognized each other as tough-talking, honest, tough guys, so they have to go through their whole, you know, tough guy routine of bonding.
Well,
won't you take me
to? Which is funny, because it's not, you know, it's like the it's like the more friendly version of McCreary and Childs. You know, they're the two alpha males, except in the thing, they're at each other's throats most of it. Here, they kind of work it out, and then they just beat the shit out of each other in an alley.
Yeah, after, you know, technical grabbing and being told to eat a trash can lid. So.
Well, I always got the feeling that Frank still wasn't very, very happy with Nada, even after he knew the truth and had to go and shoot everybody.
Yeah.
And truth be told, you know, Nada might have been able to do what he did without Frank in the first place. So Frank might have been able to go back to his wife and family if he hadn't have followed along with Nada in the first place.
Oh, well, them's the break.
Kind of doesn't work out too well for Frank in this one.
Yeah. Another, just a couple interesting notes here. I talked before about when they take out the shantytown, it was that kind of quiet intensity. Yes, Mike, intensity. You compare that to the raid on their safe house in the third act. And that's the other interesting thing. Let me segue to that real quick. This is a very strong three-act structure. This movie's like 92 minutes or 94 minutes, something like that, and like every act is like almost exactly half an hour. Because it's like, okay.
Yeah, you're right.
Frank, it's like the first act, you know, Nada's coming into town, you know, weird stuff's going on, you know, not really sure what's going on. Then second act, gets the glasses, it's
Chase.
Nada on the run on his own. Third act, Nada convinces Frank, Nada's part of a larger group, and they're going on the offensive. It's almost exactly down to the half hour. It's like very classical 3X structure there. But again, comparing the pogrom with the siege on the safe house, you go from a quiet intensity to like a hardcore gun battle. You know, it's just nasty at this point. It's almost as if, you know, we tried to get rid of you people, and now we're going to have to get mean.
Well, these people that they're getting rid of, there's no pretending with them. With the people in the people in the tent city, you know, that's sort of a public campaign. You have to approach that like real cops. Whereas in here, it's like, no, motherfuckers, we hate you. We're going to kill you.
This
starts out by they blow open. They don't go in through the door. They blow the wall open.
And you can see the shocked face
on Holly, who, you know, spoiler alert, she's a, you know, she probably knew. She was probably with them at that point.
Yeah, I always thought Holly was the tip-off.
Right. She was the tip-off. But then there's a point there where she realizes, holy shit,
they'll kill her too.
They're about to kill me. You know, I don't want to say George because I don't know if that was his name in the movie, but Nada saves her life there. And you would have thought at that point maybe she would have turned on him and thought, well, but you know, no, she actually goes back again. On top of it, but. But yeah, I love that, you know, after watching it, you know, the second time, I've always noticed there's a look on her face where she goes, oh, holy shit, I've been used, you know, and now I'm going to die here in this. They promised me, you know, the rest of my life living in luxury, and now I'm going to die here,
Which makes you wonder, what did they give her when she went back to the studio? What did they buy her loyalty with?
Right.
You know, to keep the wrestling allegory rolling, everybody's got a price.
Making his summer home in Hyannis Port, Massachusetts.
Money.
That's all about, baby. That's all about.
You know what's funny is that Ted DiBiase became a fundamentalist Christian.
Who did?
Ted DiBiase. And it's like, Ted? He's like, you used to offer to pay kids millions of dollars if they could dribble a basketball 10 times and then kick it out of their hands at 9. Fundamentalist Christian. There you go.
Well, that's just like the whole Christian thing anyway.
Well, you know, the thing is that Ted DiBiase also said in his book that, you know, Vince McMahon was his own personal Satan, yet he went back to work for him. So Satan pays well. That's all I got to say about that.
That's the thing.
I have to say the few times I've worked for Satan has paid very well also.
Yep, his checks are solid too.
That's the larger
last
work
time
was.
Satan was a woman
pays,
too.
Pays better than Satan in a can, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
I mean, all he could afford was homeless guys.
Yeah,
well,
that's
right. You know? Well, yeah, but look at those homeless guys. They're Alice Cooper homeless guys. Yeah,
they're all from his stage show.
That's A-list homeless guys anyway.
Of your top flight homeless.
I wonder how the personal trainer to Miroslav Satan feels, you know, about serving Satan.
Yeah, well, you know that there was a, you know that there was, that that's one of the top selling jerseys in the NHL just because it says, you know, Satan across the back, says Satan.
Of course, it's pronounced
Satan. Yeah.
Satan.
Nah,
whatever.
It's Satan.
It's just like
it's like Frankenstein. Like, you know, it's like your name is Satan, dude.
Yeah.
But you got a mullet.
We have
hockey.
Jesus.
You know, you probably listen to, you know, like Halloween and Gamma Ray. So your last name is Satan.
We live in Rochester and we have that hoity-toity thing where all the suburbs around here, like, okay, so we have one suburb, Chili, Chili.
Yeah.
Right? No, it's Chili.
Chili.
It's Chili.
Oh, fuck.
There's
shit.
A Charlotte.
There's a Charlotte and a Charlotte Beach.
There's a Charlotte and a Charlotte Beach. No,
but
it's not Charlotte. It's Charlotte.
Charlotte.
There's a Leroy around here, but you know what? No, it's Leroy.
We have a in South Carolina
where they make Jello.
Yeah,
down in
they do.
It's the birthplace of Jello.
It's the birthplace of Jello. The Jello Museum's there. We get Bill Cosby every once in a while.
Which, if you knew how they
Leroy.
Made that, you would never eat it again.
Oh,
hey,
I still eat it. It's nature's perfect food.
I'll eat Jell-O
Young Frankenstein.
I mean, it's you know, it's like God made all parts of animals delicious. That's all I got to say about that. But.
Yeah, I'm with
or at least gelatinous.
I was good on this one.
Didn't you run into a guy from Chile or Chile or whatever when you were in Disney, Chris?
When I was in Disney, yes, it was so funny. Yes.
Could you tell by the outrageous West Side accent?
No, I could tell because they put your hometown on.
Not your name tag.
It was in a Mexican restaurant, and somebody ahead of me goes, "Oh, you're from Chile. That's so funny because you're serving chili." Ha 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 ha. And they were actually getting Chili mixed up with Chile.
We also have
the guy was white can be.
We also have a not a Lima but a Lima.
That's a bean, man.
We have a town not called Martinez but Martinez. very cosmopolitan.
Yeah, I was gonna say one sounds like some guy with a jacked up car. The other one sounds like a resort somewhere in the tropics.
It does sound like a Caribbean resort, doesn't it?
Yeah, the weirdest thing we got in Massachusetts is Worcester, but it's Worcester.
Worcester.
It's Worcester.
Hey, and again to keep the wrestling talk going, who can forget Edge and Christian? Hello, Worcester.
Oh my God.
We are going to alienate so much of our audience with
either that or but you know when I say our audience, I'm just talking in the general nerdy audience in general, or people who like that sort of stuff. They'll check into stuff like that. We might be sowing some seeds of interest in wrestling, you know,
especially '80s stuff, you know.
Oh, well, yeah, we were 80s all kids. Wrestling.
Well, most of us were. I mean, not you, Chris. And I can't speak for you, Mike, but I'm assuming you were as well. A lot of us were kids then. We remember this crap.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I remember it well.
I like my peak of wrestling, like when I was really into wrestling, was when Andy Kaufman was involved. That was like one of the just most awesome time periods, because I that was when I got it about wrestling.
Yeah.
Because up to that point, I was like, why would I want to watch wrestling? It was fake. When I was a little kid, I would watch it with my dad because it was fun, because he'd be like, watch this. This guy's good. Oh, look. And this was where they would do – where it was sort of almost like straight-up wrestling, but every once in a while someone would pull a hammer out of his shorts and beat on the other guy, and the other guy would cut his forehead with razor blades, and then they'd bleed a lot and stuff like that. But I was always like, this is fake. But then when I saw Andy Kaufman, I realized – this is why it's awesome. Yeah.
That is why it's awesome.
I think my favorite wrestling moment as a child was watching Andre the Giant wrestle four midgets.
The midgets.
At once. It was awesome.
That is awesome.
I laughed so hard I think I had an asthma attack.
And you know, that's what it was. That was when I realized you don't have to, things don't have to be real.
Yeah.
You know, I don't. It can be fake and be
and
be
just.
You know, it's like we used to say in high school. You don't call the ballet fake because it's choreographed, do you?
Exactly, exactly. They're not really. That's
not
that
real
story
swan.
Happened 1,000 years ago. It's not real.
They're not real swans. They're just girls in leotards. I'm leaving this ballet.
You know what? Those girls in leotards might be great dancers. I'd still rather watch a dude take a jump off a 20-foot ladder onto a fucking table and go through it.
I agree.
You can't fake that shit.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, it's like Jim Ross said when they threw Mick Foley up the top of the Hell in the Cell. Some idiot at home is saying he knows how to fall.
Oh, my God, I don't believe it. My God.
If there was more falling in ballet, would you change your mind?
If there was more hardcore table action in ballet.
Creaming each other with folding chairs?
No.
Yeah.
I got it. If there's tacks and barbed wire on the...
Has there ever been a ballerina, like, wrestler?
Yes.
A wrestler?
Back in the 50s, there was a guy...
A baller wrestler?
No, I can't... he was. This was kind of in the golden age. I don't remember the guy's name.
Or did he just wear a tutu?
No, he didn't wear a tutu, but he wore... He wore like the men's leotard, and he would do like the pirouettes and stuff to freak the guy out. It's like the early days of like when wrestling was on like the Dumont Network and stuff in the 50s.
Okay,
back in the strong territory days. I do not remember this guy's name though. I
when,
he probably guys, was actually a dancer by day,
I
too.
I think we could make this into something profitable. Ballet wrestling? Come on. I think
the
we
Purettes
could,
with we the occasional really, boot to the head.
Think about this. If you put up a sign and went on a TV station going, we have ballet wrestling, we're doing Swan Lake.
Bloody Swan Lake.
10 swans enter, only one swan exits. You know, come on.
Well, hey, you know, in New York right now, they've got a world pillow fighting league where chicks wail on each other with pillows, like they use the pillow in front of their fist in bars.
Oh, so just the chicks then, huh?
It's just that one's just for chicks, yeah. But
Well, pillow fighting is traditionally a female sport.
Well, I'll huck all my chicks behind my legs.
I'm sure there's
going to
be some spoil sport guy who's like, listen, I just because I'm a guy doesn't mean I can't be in the pillow fighting league.
I had three sisters, so I made sure I always had a nice, heavy, weighted pillow, and then I'd soak it.
Soak it
as a 20-pound club.
The real trick is instead of a pillow, you bring a sack of doorknobs. Nobody sees that coming.
Yes.
or a sack of sweet Valencia oranges. Like that'll work, too.
Pepsi cans, like in Bad Boys, man. That's one of my... Not the The old '80s Bad Boys,
yeah.
with what was it? It was Emilia Estevez in that one, one of those.
That was Men at Work with Charlie Sheen and Emilia Estevez.
There was one where I can't understand even, you know, I don't think it's anything that happened back then, but there was a fight in the prison, the youth prison, but the guy went to the Coke machine and put like 10 Cokes in a pillowcase, and I was like, really? They'd let you have a Coke machine in prison? I didn't know that. You know?
You had to pay in cigarettes, though.
Yeah.
It was probably a Columbia picture, and they had to get that product placed
in. Or you either pay in cigarettes, or you got to bend over in front of the change dispenser.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Yeah, we're way off topic tonight, boys.
Well, that's what happens when Rowdy Rowdy Piper is in your movie.
Oh, I know, dog.
Early on, he's like looking in an apartment window while they're watching TV. I think that's kind of not very nice, you know, Rowdy Rowdy Peeper.
Go on, man. Go on. I know you got more of them. You better get them in now because you're just not going to get a chance otherwise. I'm going to get my Rowdy Rowdy Piper wrestling figure down.
Oh,
right,
nice,
now.
Nice. Mind your way at all?
No. Go ahead.
So when he starts taking pot shots, you know, it's Rowdy. Roddy Popper.
Hey, I like puns. Keep going, man.
You're what we call an enabler.
Oh, yeah. Total enabler.
I will say this in all seriousness. One of my absolute favorite lines that Roddy Piper ever used in a promo is very kind of indicative of Nada and of the character that Nada embodies in this film. That kind of hard luck hero who's got to rise up and fight the completely indefeatable system. You know, there was a whole famous storyline back in the '80s where Piper used to host the Piper's Pit, and Adrian Adonis destroyed the pit and took it over and turned it into the flower shop. And then it was the classic scene where Piper destroys the flower shop with a baseball bat, but he had been knocked up with an injury and he came back. And Piper's promo was on Saturday Night's Main Event, I think. And he says, you know, some Adrian, there ain't no shame in getting knocked down. No, the shame's not getting back up again. And that is the epitome.
You actually sounded like Jesse Ventura when you said that.
I don't talk like that now. But you know, in all seriousness, is that not Nada? Is that not what he embodies, what this working class hero has to embody in this society? It's not getting knocked down. There's no shame in that. It's not getting back up. It's giving up the fight. It's giving in and collaborating and taking your cut, your piece of the pie. You know, it's like we all sell out every day. Might as well be on the winning side. It's like to resist that. That's what makes you the hero.
Oh yeah, he fights to the bitter end. Did you notice his last gesture just before the whole comlink blows up? The big old middle finger sticking right out.
Yeah, like it's a John
Kurt Vonnegut novel
right there,
or Running Man ends like that in the short story.
Yeah, you're right.
The extended middle finger.
That's the total Carpenterism, you know.
Cat's Cradle, too, right?
Does Cat's Cradle start? Oh, it does start with its end with a middle finger. Yeah.
A middle finger to God.
Yeah.
A middle finger or Bokanon or whatever at that point.
But, you know, that's all I can think of with that is like this, you know, this is why Roddy Piper's in this, because he's the kind of guy that could sell that.
Oh, yeah.
It's always baffled me why he didn't have a brilliant career as an action star after this movie. And I mean, if the movie had had the success when it came out that it had over the, you know, after it came on video, maybe it would have worked out that way. But I was looking forward to seeing more Rowdy. That's what I walked away from this going, that was a great movie, and it was Roddy Piper's breakout film.
It doesn't matter. He doesn't need to do anything else because he's always going to be nada, and he's always going to be telling people to put the fucking glasses on.
Yeah,
I don't. Yeah, I don't. I don't remember what he did in Hell Comes to Frogtown. That's for sure.
Maybe he went to Frogtown. I'm not sure.
I had a weird nitpick. I want to know how putting on the glasses allowed him to hear sleep.
Yeah.
Sleep being broadcast from like the traffic lights.
I think something about it, even maybe through your visual cortex.
Oh, like just unscrambled the whole
scrambled,
signal,
yeah,
so you can see and hear
the whole. Yeah, once it defeated that signal that was coming from all the TV screens and all the little radar dishes. Then you would see and hear.
You can see the aliens. We know
everything. My favorite thing is when you'd see the little UFOs.
Yeah,
and the
I
scene,
like those.
And the scene that totally gets redone in Big Trouble in Little China, with the one creature with the multiple eyes,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking down at you, and somebody looking up at it, going,
"What the hell are you?"
And then shooting it. You know, it's almost the exact same shot for McCreary, shot.
Doesn't McCreary say something similar to that in The Thing? At the end.
It happens in Flash Gordon, too.
Oh, you're right. And it does happen in Flash Gordon, too, except he makes friends with that thing at the end of Flash Gordon.
And that's another one of your Carpenterisms. It's like, you know.
What the hell is that? Kill it. Damn, that's ugly. Kaboom.
God, I love that movie.
All right, so anyone got any closing thoughts here?
You know what? I do, but I forgot. I have them written up.
Well, you got to take better notes.
I saw a billboard I never noticed before that said the work 8 hours, sleep 8 hours, play 8 hours.
Well, that is right from the short story. There's
is
a
it?
Line in the short story when he turns on the television. That's one of the lines he hears him say is work 8 hours, sleep 8 hours, play 8 hours.
And I like one of the magazines, or a lot of the magazines, that said no ideas.
Yeah.
No ideas.
I like the dollar signs that say this is your God.
I love that
this is your God, you know, gripped in the guy's hands.
Yep.
I mean, those shots and the way he frames them, they've just lent themselves to being Photoshop and clipped art from here to eternity. I've seen it for Bush and Obama, the view of the president through and but it's easier with Obama because in the original picture it was saying obey in the back, so it's but all you can see was the O and the B, so it's just like
OB.
It just makes your job in Photoshop that much easier to make it into Obama than it did to Bush. But people were giving George Bush the same, you know, and probably every president from now on, as long as people remember this movie,
and that gets to what we were talking about at the very beginning, is that, you know, could this have been a direct knock on Reaganism and conservatism in the 80s? Possibly, but it's so applicable.
It works
for everybody.
Yeah, it's the Emperor Has No Clothes.
Yeah,
and he's naked and he's raping you.
Yeah.
Basically,
I hate to talk about Mark Miller, but you know, this is my face while I'm fucking you in the ass.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I was really with that book until that point. I was like, really?
That's yeah, I never even read the book. I just love that. I just think that line is funny and just in out of context funny.
It is kind of funny and depressing.
Mark Millar, I have a feeling he just loves I have very I didn't know that he was in the mainstream of comics. I thought he was just an underground guy who enjoyed shocking people. That's how much.
Well, you're half right.
About. Yeah.
You're half right on that.
A few of his underground comics, and I'm like, these are pretty good, but it's just somebody trying to be as extreme as they possibly can, you know?
Yeah, well, the problem is that somebody bought into his crap, so. And now he's auteur.
Good luck to him.
Good luck. Best of luck with that.
yeah. But that's about. I think that's about all I got to say about this movie. Besides, just if you haven't seen it, you definitely have to see it. Especially, you know, these things get a little sense of urgency to me of trying to get people to see They Live because I want them to go see it before the remake comes out.
Yep.
They think that's the real version of it or the version they should see because it's up to date. I don't have to worry about feeling like I don't know if I totally can buy into this movie because people have 80s clothes on or something, you know. So I need, you know, go to see this movie before they do the remake. Guaranteed it's going to be better.
Don't let the fact that it stars Roddy Piper dissuade you in any way.
No. Just the opposite.
Yeah.
You stop missing Kurt Russell after about 3 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't think Kurt Russell
it's
could
It's one
play
of
not.
Those rare occasions where I wouldn't rather have Kurt Russell as... I'd almost rather have Kurt Russell... Kurt Russell is the only one that who could have done Han Solo that I would have been, like, okay with, you know? I would have loved a Kurt Russell.
You definitely couldn't have had Kurt Russell coming off of Big Trouble in Little China doing that role.
No.
There's no way.
No. So, there's if there was a fight for this role, Roddy Piper would have wiped the floor with Kurt Russell, and that's saying something coming out of my mouth.
I think your listeners should watch this movie if for no other reason than there's so much pithy dialogue in it. We didn't even scratch the surface. There's a lot more.
Yeah. And we always talk about on this show in particular that, you know, this is a movie that's not just a geek show. This is a movie that makes you think, and
my wife loves this movie.
Yeah, there's layers of meaning here. Like almost all of Carpenter's successful films, it exists on more than one level, and it functions beautifully on more than one level. And this is kind of the perfect example of that. And you can watch this just as an alien invasion. In fact, its international title was Invasion Los Angeles. But then you can really watch it and sit down with it, and you'll find yourself coming back to this movie a couple of days after, thinking, man, you know, I was like, damn it, I didn't even think of that at the time.
I love movies that look just like they're sort of a pulpy good time, but then have like, I like those movies that are like that, and then have layers of subtext in them more than the ones that try to be. Although I do love arty, pretentious, slow, you know, movies, I will say that I do love movies like that. I love it even more when you can have basically a trashy movie with great, you know, social commentary and subtext and stuff that makes you think, because that's the stuff that gets you after you've seen it.
Right.
You're watching it and you're just in the excitement of it. You're being propelled by the suspense. And then when you start putting a little thought to it, even if it's not going to go, you know, incredibly under a lot of scrutiny, it's, you know, stuff starts coming out and you start noticing it. And this movie, every time I see it, I see something new, you know. I pick out something that I've never seen before, you know, or something that says something that I never, you know, put together before.
That's all.
So there's my second last word.
I mean, that pretty much says it all. You know, They Live is like an onion.
And it'll make you cry. It'll bring a tear to your eye.
It will, especially.
Like that just reminded that.
Ron Parker.
I can't take credit for that line. That was this womanizer friend of mine in college named Mel, who was the first person I saw who was just like, yo, that girl's got an onion butt.
Yeah.
Oh, onion booty. Like
it was like a Fat Albert where we were all like, onion booty? What do you mean, onion booty? What, it's shaped like an onion? No, man.
Yeah.
We didn't tease the next movie.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we got to tell them what's coming next.
Well, I'll tease it.
And, okay.
Oh, pray your cause, right? You'll really hear about it.
Oh, my God.
That's right, baby. The Pork Chop Express. And you listen to The Vault on a dark and stormy night. Just listen to the show.
I love that movie, too.
And like Tom Servo, I have a big thing for Kim Cattrall.
They call her Laugh, you know.
And Estelle Winwood, but I prefer Kim Cattrall.
You know, it could be worse. You could be like Gypsy and have a big thing for Richard Basehart.
Right.
Oh, Richard right. Basehart? Anyway, yes. So for those people who are not familiar, our next film is going to be, take it, Chris.
Big Trouble in Little China, another classic. Masterpiece. Yeah, classic.
Oh, huge buzz.
Hey, Jack Burton's so only worried back. About one thing, and that's Jack Burton. Okay.
Yeah, come back next time and get a nice big heaping mug full of the black blood of the earth. And we don't mean oil.
Yeah,
the black blood of the earth.
Black blood of the earth.
And jade green eyes.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy. And there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.
"8 o'clock in the morning" by Ray Nelson. At the end of the show, the hypnotist told his subjects, "Awake!" And something unusual happened. One of the subjects awoke all the way. This had never happened before. His name was George Nada, and he blinked out at the sea of faces in the theater, at first unaware of anything out of the ordinary. Then he noticed, spotted here and there in the crowd, the non-human faces. The faces of the fascinators. They had been there all along, of course, but only George was really awake, so only George recognized them for what they were. He understood everything in a flash, including the fact that if he were to give away any outward sign, the fascinators would instantly command him to return to his former state, and he would obey. He left them in the theater, pushing out into the neon night, carefully avoiding any indication that he saw the green reptilian flesh or the multiple yellow eyes of the rulers of the Earth. One of them asked him,
"Got a light, buddy?"
George gave him a light, then moved on. At intervals along the street, George saw the posters hanging with photographs of the Fascinator's multiple eyes and various commands printed under them, such as, "Work 8 hours, play 8 hours, sleep 8 hours, and marry and reproduce." A TV set in the window of a store caught George's eye, but he looked away in the nick of time. When he didn't look at the Fascinator in the screen, he could resist the command, "Stay tuned to this station." George lived alone in a little sleeping room, and as soon as he got home, the first thing he did was disconnect the TV set. In the other room, he could hear the TV sets of his neighbors, though. Most of the time, the voices were human, but now and then he heard the arrogant, strangely bird-like croaks of the aliens.
"Obey the government," said one croak. "We are the government,"
said another.
"We are your friends. You'd do anything for a friend, wouldn't you? Obey. Work."
Suddenly, the phone rang. George picked it up. It was one of the Fascinators.
"Hello,"
it squawked.
"This is your control, Chief of Police Robinson. You're an old man, George Nada. Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, your heart will stop. Please repeat."
"I'm an old man," said George. "Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, my heart will stop." The control hung up. "No, it won't," whispered George. He wondered why they wanted him dead. Did they suspect that he was awake? Probably. Someone might have spotted him, noticed that he didn't respond the way the others did. If George were alive at 1 minute after 8 tomorrow morning, then they would be sure. No use waiting here for the end, he thought. He went out again. The posters, the TV, the occasional commands from passing aliens did not seem to have absolute power over him, though he still felt strongly tempted to obey. To see things the way his master wanted him to see them. He passed an alley and stopped. One of the aliens was alone there, leaning against the wall. George walked up to him.
"Move on,"
grunted the thing, focusing his deadly eyes on George. George felt his grasp on awareness waver. For a moment, the reptilian head dissolved into the face of a lovable old drunk. Of course the drunk would be lovable. George picked up a brick and smashed it down on the old drunk's head with all his strength. For a moment, the image blurred, and the blue-green blood oozed out of the face and the lizard fell, twitching and writhing. After a moment, it was dead. George dragged the body into the shadows and searched it. There was a tiny radio in its pocket and a curiously shaped knife and fork in another. The tiny radio said something in an incomprehensible language. George put it down beside the body, but kept the eating utensils. I can't possibly escape, thought George. Why fight them? But maybe he could. What if he could awaken the others? That might be worth a try. He walked 12 blocks to the apartment of his girlfriend, Lil, and knocked on her door. She came to the door in her bathrobe. I want you to wake up, he said.
I'm awake, she said. Come on in.
He went in. The TV was playing. He turned it off. No, he said. I mean, really wake up. She looked at him without comprehension, so he snapped his fingers and shouted, Wake up! The master's command that you wake up! Are you off your rocker, George? She asked suspiciously. You sure are acting funny. He slapped her face. Cut that out, she cried. What the hell are you up to anyway? Nothing, said George, defeated. I was just kidding around. Slapping my face wasn't just kidding around, she cried. And there was a knock at the door. George opened it. It was one of the aliens.
Can't you keep the noise down to a dull roar?
It said. The eyes and reptilian flesh faded a little, and George saw the flickering image of a fat, middle-aged man in shirt sleeves. It was still a man when George slashed its throat with the eating knife, but it was an alien before it hit the floor. He dragged it into the apartment and kicked the door shut. What do you see there? He asked Lil, pointing to the many-eyed snake thing on the floor. Mr. Coney, she whispered, her eyes wide with terror. You just killed him like it was nothing at all. Don't scream, warned George, advancing on her. I won't, George. I swear I won't. Only please, for the love of God, put down that knife. She backed away until she had her shoulder blades pressed to the wall. George saw that it was no use. I'm going to tie you up, said George. First tell me which room Mr. Coney lived in. The first door on your left as you go towards the stairs, she said. Georgie, Georgie, don't torture me. If you're going to kill me, do it clean. Please, Georgie, please. He tied her up with bedsheets and gagged her, and then searched the body of the fascinator. There was another one of the little radios that talked the foreign language. Another set of eating utensils and nothing else. George went next door. When he knocked, one of the snake things answered.
Who is it?
Friend of Mr. Coney. I want to see him, said George.
He went out for a second, but he'll be right back.
The door opened a crack and four yellow eyes peeped out.
You want to come in and wait?
Okay, said George, not looking at the eyes. You alone here, he asked, as it closed the door, its back to George.
Yeah, why?
He slit its throat from behind, then searched the apartment. He found human bones and skulls, a half-eaten hand. He found tanks with huge fat slugs floating in them. The children, he thought, and killed them all. There were guns, too, of a sort he had never seen before. He discharged one by accident, but fortunately it was noiseless. It seemed to fire little poison darts. He pocketed the gun and as many boxes of darts as he could and went back to Lil's place. When she saw him, she writhed in helpless terror. Relax, honey, he said, opening her purse. I just want to borrow your car keys. He took the keys and went downstairs to the street. Her car was still parked in the same general area in which she always parked it. He recognized it by the dent in the right fender. He got in, started it, and began driving aimlessly. He drove for hours, thinking desperately, searching for some way out. He turned on the car radio to see if he could get some music. But there was nothing but news, and it was all about him, George Nada, the homicidal maniac. The announcer was one of the masters, but he sounded a little scared. Why should he be? What could one man do? George wasn't surprised when he saw the roadblock, and he turned off on a side street before he reached it. No little trip to the country for you, Georgie boy, he thought to himself. They had just discovered what he had done back at Lil's place, so they would probably be looking for Lil's car. He parked it in an alley and took the subway. There were no aliens in the subway for some reason. Maybe they were too good for such things, or maybe it was just because it was so late at night. When one finally did get on, George got off. He went up to the street and went into a bar. One of the fascinators was on TV saying over and over again,
"We are your friends. We are your friends. We are your friends."
The stupid lizard sounded scared. Why? What could one man do against all of them? George ordered a beer. Then it suddenly struck him that the fascinator on TV no longer seemed to have any power over him. He looked at it again and thought, it has to believe it can master me to do it. The slightest hint of fear on its part and the power to hypnotize is lost. They flashed George's picture on the TV screen and George retreated to the phone booth. He called his control, the chief of police. Hello, Robinson, he asked.
Speaking.
This is George Nada. I figured out how to wake people up.
What? George, hang on. Where are you?
Robinson sounded almost hysterical. He hung up and paid and left the bar. They would probably trace his call. He caught another subway and went downtown. It was dawn when he entered the building housing the biggest of the city's TV studios. He consulted the building director and then went up in the elevator. The cop in the front of the studio recognized him. Why, you're Nada, he gasped. George didn't like to shoot him with the poison dart gun, but he had to. He had to kill several more before he got into the studio itself, including all the engineers on duty. There were a lot of police sirens outside, excited shouts and running footsteps on the stairs. The alien was sitting before the TV camera saying,
"We are your friends! We are your friends!"
and didn't see George come in. When George shot him with the needle gun, he simply stopped in mid-sentence and sat there, dead. George stood near him and said, imitating the alien croak. Wake up! Wake up! See us as we are and kill us! It was George's voice the city heard that morning, but it was the Fascinator's image, and the city did awake for the very first time, and the war began. George did not live to see the victory that finally came. He died of a heart attack at exactly 8 o'clock